This is New York firefighter Raphael Poirier. Introducing Firehouse Subs' new $4.99 choice subs. Choose from a medium smoked turkey, honey ham, or roast beef. And remember, a part of every sub you buy helps provide life-saving equipment for first responders. Medium $4.99 choice subs. Firehouse Subs. Enjoy more subs. Save more lives. Limited time only, plus tax, no substitutions. Participating locations. Firehouse Subs will donate a minimum of $1 million in 2018 to Firehouse Subs Public Safety Foundation by donating 0.13% of every purchase.
Episode of the Hope Illuminated Podcast, your source for the stories, science, and strategy of suicide prevention, mental health promotion, and resilience, where we live, learn, and work. I'm your host, Dr. Sally Fletcher-Thomas, and I'm on a life mission to empower communities with solutions that help people overcome isolation and despair and rekindle a passion for living. Each episode, we're joined by international experts who inspire hope and offer real guidance. Welcome to the show. I'm so grateful you're here. We have a very, very important and needed discussion today with two leading authorities on suicide prevention and living through despair, but especially thinking about our older populations. We have Yates Conwell calling in today from Rochester, New York, and Heidi Bryan from Wisconsin, and I'll introduce them in just a second. This is a really important conversation. I think, you know, when it comes to thinking about suicide prevention in our culture, almost always in the general population, we immediately think of our youth. And obviously, we don't want our youth to die of suicide. We don't want our youth to die of anything. And so it makes sense why we're focused on their needs and what we can do to support them. But we have a growing aging population, and the more we learn about aging populations and their risk for suicide, the more it's important for us to figure some things out here. Especially among our older white males, the suicide rates are particularly high. And this really requires a public health approach. So we really need to be enrolling not just family members and friends, but also our healthcare providers, our policymakers, all folks can play a role here in how we can best support our elders. Our goals really are about listening. You know, how do we listen to our elders to make sure that we're picking up on clues and what they're needing in terms of alleviating any of their distressing symptoms emotionally, symptoms related to pain, symptoms related to depression or anxiety, or some things just coping with life events like loss and transitions. even post-retirement. We always think of that as just such a positive transition, but for a lot of our elders, it comes with some difficulties. It comes with some challenges of who am I and where did my social circles go? So all of these are important, as well as reducing risk and increasing reasons for living throughout the lifespan. This conversation is focused a little bit more maybe on empowering our caregivers and our wellness partners in support roles and how we can kind of increase our ability to give palliative care. But it's also about people who maybe are living with chronic suicidal thoughts and chronic depression and what changes as they get older and what we need to be thinking about. So I'm inspired looking at the elders in my family. I know that, if we look at Thomas Joyner's model of suicide risk, for all of us, what's really important in buffering ourselves from the tragedy of suicide is how connected we are with other people and how we are connected to a purpose in life. And when I think about, like, my mom, for example, I cannot keep up with her social schedule. She's turning 80 this year. She's got bridge and golf and the University Women's Club, and she's engaged with her alma mater, Mount Holyoke. She is in a theater club with a bunch of other seniors. She does a La Cuisine cooking event once a month or something with other neighbors. And, of course, she's very much a part of the village that takes care of my children and other grandchildren she has. So she's so busy, and she's so connected, and I really think that's really helped her overall health and emotional health in particular. So with that, let me transition to introduce our amazing guest today. Again, Yates Conwell calling in from Rochester, New York today. He's a professor of psychiatry at the University of Rochester School of Medicine and Dentistry. He's also the director of the University of Rochester's Medical Center, Office of Aging, Research, and Health Services. And he's the co-director for the University of Rochester Center on the Study of and Prevention of Suicide. He's the immediate past president of the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention and the chair of its scientific council. Dr. Conwell received his medical training at the University of Cincinnati and completed his psychiatry residency and fellowship in geriatric psychiatry at Yale University School of Medicine. In addition to teaching and service system development, Dr. Conwell maintains a clinical practice with older adults and directs an interdisciplinary program of research in aging, mental health services, and suicide prevention. And Dr. Conwell was just out here in Colorado. We were so lucky to have him here. He presented at our regional conference, the suicide prevention conference we have for the Rocky Mountain West states, and just gave it a spectacular talk that was incredibly rich with the science, but also very useful and practical. So we'll hear from you in just a second. My other guest today is Heidi Bryan. A dear, dear friend and colleague, co-founder with me with the United Suicide Survivors International. Heidi is a suicide attempt survivor who also lost her brother to suicide. She's been working in the suicide prevention field since 1998 as an advocate, QPR master trainer, speaker, and author. She founded Feeling Blue Suicide Prevention Council in 1998, which is now known as Prevent Suicide Pennsylvania. She served as the National Action Alliance for Suicide Prevention Attempt Survivor Task Force and is currently on the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline Consumer Survivor Committee with me as well. And she's authored several books, so I just want to point your attention to these because these are really helpful for lost survivors and attempt survivors and friends and family. And she contributed to a very important resource published by SAMHSA called Journey Toward Health and Hope. So good hello to both of you. Welcome.
Hi, glad to be here.
Hey, great. Yates, let's start off with you. Tell us a little. Yeah, hi, Heidi. Welcome here. Tell us a little bit more, Yates, about your backstory. How did you get interested in this topic of older adults and suicide prevention in particular?
Oh, that goes back a ways. I'd always been interested in older people and what they have to teach us. No doubt related to having very positive role models of successful aging in my family, which tends to be pretty long-lived, fortunately. And then in college, I had the opportunity to work for quite a while as an aide in a physical rehabilitation hospital. And the people I worked with tended to be really all ages, but a great many were older people who were there recovering following falls, broken hips, strokes, and the like, the things that are so common as part of the process of aging. And really what intrigued me so much and inspired me was how they were able, those, and almost all did, successfully to take advantage of the rehab opportunity by drawing on these deep wells of resilience and sort of hidden strength that had something to do with the lives that they lived and the lessons that they learned along the way. So I got interested in medicine and in geriatrics in particular, but then also something about the psychology of aging, and then in medical school and then in residency, the stark contrast between those older people who manage the slings and arrows, as it were, of aging, and those who fell apart with suicide really as kind of the ultimate bad outcome, as it were, in almost all cases. And I realize that there's a lot of interesting discussion we can have about when suicide at the end of life is a rational decision. Glad to have that conversation. But I'm really talking about the people who developed who were unable to cope with the challenges that they face and became suicidal, where some additional help would have changed the trajectory for them. So my effort in over many years with colleagues from many different disciplines has really been trying to understand that, trying to give all older people facing devastating challenges in their lives to find that source of strength to help get them through. And it's a source of ongoing inspiration, frankly. So it's very positive work.
Oh, thank you so much, H. This is a great introduction. I'm going to come back and follow up with some of those themes. But first, let me have Heidi take a chance here to introduce herself. Welcome, Heidi.
Thanks, Allie, and thank you for inviting me. And I'm so glad to be here with you and Yates and discussing this topic. So thank you. I got involved in suicide prevention after my brother, and I was living in Pennsylvania. And Pennsylvania has a high older adult population, so I started to just realize that we needed to do something about that, just from the numbers' sake. But then my father was the youngest of 15, so my cousins are like 20 years older than me and things. So my cousin, who sang in our wedding, killed himself. And then a couple years later, my uncle, who was 90, went to the doctor, must have gotten some kind of diagnosis that he didn't like, and came home and killed himself. So, and these are both, you know, older adults, so that also really piqued my interest in working on suicide prevention and with older adults. But recently, I also struggle with chronic suicidality, and I'm getting old. It hit me 2 years ago that, oh my God, I'm like, it just kind of all came together, and it hit me that I'm getting old, and it just threw me for a loop. So I thought I'd like to start addressing this. I think this is a topic we don't talk about enough, so that's why I'm involved in it now.
Thank you so much, Heidi. And if anyone's been reading my recent blog post, you also know that I'm struggling with the aging issue as well. There's all kinds of things that I used to be able to do that I can't do anymore, and what does that mean for me and so forth. So I really appreciate you talking about that as well. I want to go first to Heidi, just to explain a little bit of what you mean by chronic suicidality. I think for many people, this is a relatively new concept, that most people think of suicide as a crisis, suicide that has a very acute beginning, middle, and an end. But yet we know that there are a lot of people for which, as my friend Frank King says, suicide is always on the menu. It's just something that's always lingering there. And if you can talk about that a little bit, about what that has meant for your own life circumstance.
Sure. And it's very hard for me to remember a time when I wasn't suicidal. I think it developed as a coping mechanism, as something I could turn to. It soothed me just thinking about it, and planning it was a distraction, really, and would soothe me. And it just became so ingrained in me that it's there. It's just part of me. It's always there. It's just, once it's in your toolbox, it's in your toolbox. And so I just tend to go there. If I don't take care of myself, if I don't eat right, exercise, do the positive things, and I suddenly am stressed or in a very stressful situation, my first instinct is to just start to go down that suicidal rabbit hole. And I've learned how to combat those thoughts and not go down there, but it still comes up from time to time.
Thank you for sharing that's great. Thank you for that's such an important thing for people to get their minds wrapped around. And also, just because someone always has suicide on the menu doesn't mean they're at risk. I mean, I think that's another thing that we just need to help people realize, that people have incredible coping skills and resilience that they can learn to, as you have, prevent them from going into that rabbit hole. And they can live through those periods when it starts popping up. One more question to Heidi, and then I'll just turn it back to you, Yates, with my follow-up questions. So you had mentioned that as you're getting older, it's more complicated. Can you just talk a little bit about what you mean by that, or as you watched your relatives get older, you noticed some additional complications for them in managing this?
Yes, well, my mother, as she aged, was a great example of how I didn't want to end up, because she just kind of retreated and felt like she couldn't do anything and gave up driving. She just gave up, basically, and did not have a very positive attitude toward it. So I had an example of how I didn't want to be. And then on the other side, I had an aunt who was just the exact opposite. So I had a great example. She was 90 and still working, and, you know, so I had another example of how I would like to be, which helped me a lot. But I guess I just wasn't prepared for the aches and pains that start to come along. Your memory isn't as good. You feel like that you have a loss in status, that you're just not as valued as much in your community and in your occupation. There just is this subtle, I feel like we have an emphasis more on the younger and the middle age than we do the older adult. And I felt it. And just all the physical things that come with it. And my husband is 9 years older than me. And I saw his decline. I mean, it's not severe or anything, but I saw what was going to be happening to me in the next 9 years.
That's right. So comes with it, with the territory, some decline in functionality, some change in status perhaps, but it also comes with some incredible gifts and things that, you know, that I treasure as I get older are the longstanding friendships that I have are absolutely priceless. You know, people who knew me when I was a kid are still in my life, like absolutely priceless experiences for me to be with folks. I also think about, you know, when I look at my faith community, the number of people in my faith community who are older adults who are so richly contributing to the spirituality and the practices and the wisdom of those experiences. So Yates, let me turn it back to you. You had brought up, the important focus of the resilience of our elders and looking at the psychology of aging, not only through a lens of decline, but also on the positive strengths. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah. I think it's really important to try to distinguish, be as clear as we can be about what the experience of the older person is versus what the fears are of the aging experience that younger and middle-aged people have. You look at the data, and it's interesting and clear and repeatedly found that if you ask older people and middle-aged and younger people about their satisfaction with their lives, it's higher in older adulthood than in middle-aged and earlier adulthood. Older people, in general, are happier than other segments of the population, and yet that gets lost often in these discussions. Why is that? The aging psychology talks about the fact that as you age, your values change. You tend to value deeper, smaller numbers of relationships, for example, that closeness, intimacy, connectedness are high on the value scale, whereas for middle-aged and younger people, it's other things. It's sort of quantity rather than quality, as it were, to kind of make a cartoon out of it. So there is a lot of opportunity. I think the concern that often arises is that, as Heidi was saying, older people aren't valued so much. There are these social constructs that get superimposed on the aging process that raise real challenges for us. So I think the thing to remember is that aging need not be bad, and in general, on average, it's a real positive thing. So what's going on when it isn't perceived and experienced that way? How much is a remediable challenge? What kinds of help do older people need in order to find that satisfaction? And to what extent is it a social construct that's being placed on us in thinking about aging for ourselves and for everyone else?
Yeah, that's a really important point, because when you look at the risks for suicide by gender and by racial and ethnic groups, it's not the same for all people. Some groups are going up and some groups are going down end of life. And I always think about how different subpopulations are valuing their elders as a big component of that. You know, if they're in positions of leadership in their family or in their communities, if they are, if they have a strong sense of connection and belonging within those communities, then, you know, chances are they're going to be buffered from some of the other contributing factors of that isolation and disconnect. Since you brought it up in your earlier comments, Yates, I also want to come back to you and just circle around on the quote-unquote rational decision end of life. I don't think we can get around older adult suicide without talking about – okay, Yates, back at you.
Okay, so the concern about what is called rational suicide, for example, it's just a very complicated issue, and I'm not sure that suicide is a very helpful construct in that conversation. As we, I think, should get into what do we know about suicide and the factors that are associated with it, and then the conversation becomes, well, what's going on when those things aren't there? But the fact is that they are there almost 100% of the time, not always, and it's not to say that self-determination around end of life, which is what I'd prefer to think of in rare circumstances, isn't a good thing. I think it is. It's more than the question of how that self-determination gets found and then what the person's able to do with it. I realize how vague that is, but I think when we talk about rational suicide, it's such a complicated issue. Sometimes it's helpful to talk about specific instances, which I don't have right now.
Thank you. I just feel like it comes up a lot of conversations that I have as well, and so it's helpful to just address, like, we're thinking about it. It's complicated. You know, ethicists and philosophers have been struggling with it for centuries. I'm not sure it's all going to get sorted out, but, you know, most of us in this work are in the work for alleviating suffering and to help people come back to a fulfilling life. And so, that's what we're focused on. So thank you for that.
Sure. I think if just to add, as it relates to this issue of the social constructs, it's just so important to
get to a place where older people are valued. And when that's the case, it opens up a whole different range of options for helping to manage the person who would otherwise be at risk. There's a construct in epidemiology called years of potential life lost, which is essentially meaning that a suicide in younger and middle adulthood is associated with greater loss to society and to others because of the number of years that that person might have lived had they not taken their own life. And inherent in that, it's an important concept, but there should also be a concept which I call years of experience in life lost. The value of a lost life to suicide in later life is potentially enormous because of the knowledge, experience, wisdom, and how we need as a society to tap into those.
You're just coming up with some gems here, Yates. Thank you so much. That's a beautiful reframe and absolutely a totally important way to frame the conversation. Heidi, back to you, because I know that not only are you thinking about your own experience and your witness of your relatives going through this, but you're also very focused on, as you call them, well-being partners in this work. I just wanted to know what your thoughts are. If there are friends and family who have an elder in their life that they're worried about, things that they might be thinking about, or what you thought about that group.
Yes, I always go back to the same refrain, I think, and that is just talk to them. Ask them what's going on. How are you doing? I'm noticing something. I notice that you just don't seem interested in anything anymore. I notice that you're talking about being a burden. I notice you just seem off. You're making these remarks like you aren't valued anymore. Like, what's going on? And just talk about it. Which I'm very fortunate. My husband does that, and I'm fortunate to have him, that I can talk to him about it. And usually that's helped. That's all I need.
Thank you. And also, I'm just interested in your shift in language from caregiver or caretaker to well-being partner or wellness partner. I think it's kind of neat.
Yes, I just don't like the term caretaker, because to me that implies almost like, well, then someone's the caregiver and someone takes and someone gives, and it's kind of hierarchical, and I just don't like that. So I think it's more you work together. You're partners in each other's wellness. You want to create a wellness plan for each other, and that's why I started to call them wellness partners.
I love it. And also, when you think about that sense of burdensomeness, right? Oh no, someone has to be my caregiver.
Yes.
I'm troubling them. I'm burdening them. They have to look out for me. They have to take care of me. Versus, no, we're actually in this together. We look out for one another. I think it's a really important shift. Thank you. All right, I'm going to go back to Yates and talk a little bit more about the science. You're like really one of the global experts on the research around older adult suicide, and you have so much to share. So I'll just open it up to wherever you want to start about what you think some of these hot topics are. You've already shared some about these really important findings that help guide our thinking and action.
Sure. I do hope Heidi and I can reflect together on this, because it's clear that the experts are those who study the thing, but also those who experience the thing. So let's work together on this as wellness partners. we know that older adults are at greater risk for suicide for many reasons, and it's reflected in the numbers worldwide, where people in the old age groups in the majority of countries around the world have higher rates of suicide than younger and middle-aged people. An interesting aspect of that in the United States is that it's true only for men, and white men in particular, that women tend to have higher rates in midlife, and then they drop a bit in the old age group, which is something we don't fully understand but would love to. Suicide rates among men in this country tend to be far higher than among women overall, and then that difference is even further exaggerated in later life. So we need to need to understand much more from the perspective of the individual who is aging and how that relates to gender and the kinds of skills one has learned and can exercise into older adulthood. We've talked about the five D's in the past, and that's one way to kind of get your hands around the big five risk factors, as it were, for suicide in older people. And I call them five D's because they're depression, disease, and disability are two and three, and then the fourth being disconnectedness, and the fifth being deadly means, access to firearms in particular in the United States. And we could go through each of those just very quickly if that would be useful.
Yes, please.
So depression, and by that I mean clinical depression, the kind of illness for which we have effective treatments, both in terms of medications and psychotherapies that have been shown again and again to be useful in reducing depressive illness, is associated more closely with suicide in older adults than is any other psychiatric illness, and more so that link is tighter between depression and suicide in older people than in younger and middle-aged people where other problems creep in as well, like substance misuse and psychotic illness and so on. So where there is depression in older adulthood, there is risk for suicide. The good news about that, though, is, as I referenced before, that we have treatments for that. The challenge then is how to recognize when somebody has clinically significant depressive symptoms that requires assessment and potentially treatment. And doing that early enough in the process that that it doesn't overwhelm the person, making them suicidal and then having them act on it. The trick there for older people, of course, is that many of the symptoms of depression overlap with those that are commonly associated with physical illness in aging. So things like fatigue, pains, trouble concentrating, sleep disturbance, these things can be very commonly associated with things like arthritis and heart disease and so on. So that it takes some time teasing apart whether those kinds of symptoms are due to clinical depressive illness for which treatment is indicated or are indicative of other underlying problems for which a different approach would be necessary. And another aspect of that is older people don't tend to talk about their emotional states very much. Things like depression and suicidal ideation are even more stigmatized in general in the older adults. So it's hard to get to that conversation. And another piece of it is that older people don't see mental health providers, and mental health providers in general don't have the training and working and experience working with older people that they need. So we need to be looking elsewhere, like in primary care, as a place to facilitate detection and intervention of the at-risk older person, which ties us to the second and third D's, which is disease and disability. Where there is physical illness and where there is disability associated with that, those also contribute to risk in older people where they are so common, albeit at a relatively low level. I think the fourth D, disconnectedness, is a big one for a lot of reasons. Not only that it gets very common in older people to become socially disconnected and disengaged, but also that it is a state that we can do something about. Older people, if they have physical illness and disabilities, maybe can't drive, maybe they've got hearing or vision problems, which interferes with their ability to relate to their friends and family comfortably. These are very common reasons why overall older people tend to be a little bit more vulnerable to that. Loneliness is common across the adult lifespan and also in older adulthood, and we know that those things contribute to suicide risk. We also know, though, that they are changeable. We can intervene in ways, if we're mindful about it, that maintain social connectedness or help older people who have become socially isolated re-engage in ways that help them find meaning, and that is a protective strategy. And then lastly, deadly means, and I mentioned that was firearms. Here in the United States, overall about 50% of people who take their own lives do so with a firearm. Older people, interestingly, it's up to 75% that the great majority of older people who die do so with a firearm. That's, again, a function in part of the fact that men are so much more often the victims of suicide in later life, that the that men, but maybe particularly in that age group, old adults who went through Second World War and now Vietnam and on to Korea, have often had exposure to and have comfort with firearms and have them in the home. So firearms are a big part of the story in suicide and suicide prevention for older people. And again, difficult one to tackle for social reasons, but important to know about if you're dealing with, for example, depressed, disabled, isolated older person who has a firearm in the home, simply helping secure that person's safety while they may be in a dangerously vulnerable state could be a life-saving intervention. And then the last thing I'd say about all of that, for which there is a ton of scientific evidence, is that it's never one thing, right? We don't see suicide, fortunately, happening very often. It's actually very rare, even though depressive symptoms are relatively common. Disease and disability are very common, and social disconnectedness is as well. So it's not one thing. It's when this stuff starts to mount up. It's when the older man who has an illness, a chronic physical illness, and then develops some disability associated with it, becomes withdrawn, socially isolated, his risk is rising slowly. And then if he becomes depressed on top of that, a clinical depressive syndrome, and has a firearm in his home, that's a man whose risk is very high. So the algorithms we need to use as clinicians, the algorithms we need to be aware of and sensitive to, are those of caring people, as Heidi was talking about, simply being alert, aware, and open to having the conversation with the older person about the things that they're facing is really the first step in making actionable that kind of evidence.
Wow, that was a tremendous amount of incredibly helpful information framed in a very practical way for all of us. I have a few follow-up questions, a couple, I guess. And then, Heidi, I'm going to come back to you about your reflections and all that Yates just shared with us. The first thing I wanted to follow up with, Yates, was the comment you made about mental health providers not having a specialty in large in working with older adults. For those who are interested in serving this population, are there specific trainings that you can get postgraduate years where you can get yourself a little bit more up to speed to be that competent provider?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great question. There's a lot of discussion about that now, as you'd imagine, not specific to suicide prevention, but that's kind of the thing about late-life suicide. If we're actually making optimal the lives of older people, the care that older people receive and need, access to care, both physical and social, then we're going to see suicide rates drop. So, you know, we talk about age-friendly health systems, for example. It's that everybody in that system, and I would say everybody in a social service system or age-friendly communities is another term that's used a great deal, where everybody has a certain knowledge of and sensitivity to the issues of aging. It can be as simple as some experience and guidance on how you talk to an older person who has hearing deficits, or how to recognize when somebody may be cognitively impaired, and how to make accommodations for that. I think one of the most important advances that we've had in the provision of mental health care that is accessible and acceptable to older people is the notion of integrated primary care, the movement of mental health services into the primary care office. So having somebody who has a background in psychology or social work or nursing with some experience working with older people and a knowledge of what depression looks like, and then can help raise that issue, facilitate the conversation, support treatment as delivered in the place where the older person is typically getting their care and is much more comfortable accepting recommendations. So lots of different approaches to that. I think there's a tremendous opportunity out there.
Thank you. Related to that, can you speak a little bit more about how we can differentiate, especially in the early stages, between dementia onset and depression?
Yeah. Well, part of what you're reflecting, I think, just to make it explicit, is that the two overlap a great deal. And the more we learn about depression and the more we learn about dementia in older people, the clearer it becomes that either can be a risk factor or an early manifestation of the other. The symptoms of clinical depression are that somebody feels low, depressed, they lose interest, there's sleep disturbance, too much or too little, appetite disturbance, too great or too low, problems with concentration, energy loss, and what we call psychomotor change, in which somebody is moving and thinking slower than they ordinarily would. And then the emergence of suicidal thoughts or death ideation, a tricky one because thinking of death is normal for old adults. So when those things come together, then it adds up to a depressive syndrome. Now, whether that is a prodrome to the development of additional cognitive impairment kind of depends. We know it's not good for you for a lot of reasons, depression that is, including the fact that it impairs cognitive functioning over time. So it's a complicated question, but you're right to raise the fact that there is overlap there.
Thank you. You did a very good job distilling down some of the essential pieces of a very complicated conversation. Heidi, back to you. What are some of the things that you resonated with or want to respond to from Yates' 5Ds and some of the discussions?
Yes, and I've been like shaking my head and thinking, well, they can't see that. But anyway, a memory came back to me the first time with my organization, which was Feeling Blue Suicide Prevention Council. We were invited to go to an older adult health fair, and we had our display, and our display has suicide prevention in the name. And we were right across, directly across from the entrance, but in the back. But when people first walked in the door, they would see our display. And I watched them. People, and this was all older adults, they went out of their way not to walk past our display. The word suicide bothered them that much that they wouldn't even walk past our display. It was amazing. It was such an eye-opening experience. I realized that we had to call it something. When we talk with older adults, we can't necessarily use the term suicide. We have to call it sadness or stress or something like that. That Yates was talking about. And
I remember thinking about the QPR video, the original video that he showed, the older couple talking about his experiences with suicide. He talked about himself in the third person, right? He said sometimes when you're old, you know,
you have to wonder about this, that, and the other thing. He talked about himself in the third person. He couldn't talk about it, his experiences in the first person. I think there's, you know, you both raised it, you know, the amount of hesitation in older adults potentially around this topic. Keep going, Heidi.
The other thing I was thinking about is, you know, I mentioned that my husband's 9 years older than me, and so I felt for a long time that I couldn't talk about him, about my own aging process, like, because he's older than me and I have no right to talk about, which is just my thinking and everything. That was just me. But finally, one day, I start talking about it, and it was such a relief. We both started to relate to each other. Oh, yeah, well, like, is this a normal pain, or is this a pain that I have to go to the doctor about, you know, and start kind of making a joke about it and everything. And it was such a great thing that I hadn't been, you know, I had been hesitant to talk to him about it, and I realized I was missing out on this huge opportunity for so long because I was afraid to. And once I started talking about it, it was so helpful. And along those veins, I was talking to Jerry Reed, who is, you know, with SPR, Suicide Prevention Resource Center, and we were talking about getting old, and he's mentioned that when he looked at his age spots on his hand or whatever it was, that he saw experience. And at that moment, I realized that was my problem, that my thinking was skewed to the negative and not to the positive. Here was someone who was thinking about it positively, and I'd been looking at it all wrong. And so I had to start to think of it as experience, as a plus. And then it made me realize that I had to change other things. So I got involved in a local organization because I'm an introvert and I work from home. So I was isolating myself. So I forced myself to get more involved in the community and those kinds of things. And that's what helped me to get over my chronic suicidality that was triggered with me starting to get old.
Beautiful. But, and such a great takeaway for all of us, really, when we think about our aging process. You know, I think about, you know, the wrinkles. Well, where do they come from? They come from me smiling, and they come from me thinking really hard. My biggest wrinkles are me smiling and thinking really hard. So that's all good. Heidi, I want to ask you one more question that I think is also a really important thing for us to wrestle with, and that is this idea of self-determination around means. So when our, you know, when our conversation goes around reducing access to potentially lethal means, you know, we talk about, you know, potentially removing the firearm from the home or reducing access to some of the potentially lethal medications. And I know, especially around the medication issue, that can feel a little bit like infantilizing the situation. Well, you can't handle your medication, so let me just give you the one or two for today. And I just think that's especially difficult when we're talking about an aging population where potentially the wellness partner is an adult child and the roles are reversed. I just think there's something there for us to discuss. Do you have thoughts on that?
Yes, and you're right. No one likes to be told what to do or made to feel like they can't manage themselves. So a power struggle can easily occur with, say, medication or even, you know, just give me your bullets. You don't have to, you know, give me everything, but just let me have your bullets for now or something. But I think if you can try and frame it in the terms like, this is only temporary. This is only temporary until we get you over this hump. And I'm only doing it because I care about you and love you. It's just, it's for you. I'm doing it for you. I'm not doing it to hurt you. I'm not doing it to make you feel bad. I'm not doing it to take away any of your rights. I'm doing it because I care about you and I want to keep you as safe as possible.
Great. So really building in that respect and dignity piece. And whenever possible, a collaborative effort as well. Like, what can we agree on together that can help keep you safer for now? Let's just turn in the last few minutes here about kind of some top takeaways for our audience.
either for themselves as aging adults or older adults, or for people in their life that they're worried about who may be experiencing suicidal thoughts and behavior. But Yates, let's start with you. What are some of your top takeaways that you want people to know about, resources perhaps that they can access, action steps that they can take?
Yeah. I guess one thing that's really important to underscore is that just as Heidi was saying, and I think it's extremely wise and important, is that these are, for all intents and purposes, the acutely suicidal state, even if superimposed on a chronic state, are transient. Right? That this is a fluctuating phenomenon, and if we can keep somebody safe during that period when they might otherwise act, then we've saved a life. In an older person, a suicide attempt is much more likely to be lethal because the older person is more frail, has more comorbid medical conditions, is less likely to be able to rise above a self-injury that might otherwise be less of a problem for a younger middle-aged person, and that older person is much more likely to have access to and use a firearm, which would be immediately lethal. So our task is really to recognize when somebody's going off the tracks that much earlier. We call that selective preventive intervention, to prevent the development of the acutely suicidal state, because once that has developed, an older person is in at much greater risk. So if you see in yourself or in an older family member or friend signs that they may be having those kinds of problems, that things aren't going right, again, going back to what Heidi said at the beginning of the hour, ask the question, have the conversation. It's a caring and immensely therapeutic thing to do, just to be able to talk. And older people have that strength. They've lived through stuff. They're prepared to have that conversation and then to make good use of it. So that'd be the first thing that I'd highlight. The second, again, something that we were just talking about, that as you age, as we all age, to spend a lot of thought and attention in maintaining our engagement in life and engagement with other people, because that is fundamentally important and necessary. Even as the circumstances change and challenge our ability to do that, we can find other ways that work for older people to stay engaged.
Sorry. Heidi, do you have any final takeaways?
Yes, although I think Yates got most of them. But I was thinking of a woman I had met in Pennsylvania who said that when we lose an old person, we lose a library. And that has always resonated with me, and especially now that I've lost both my parents and I don't have anyone to go back about family history or things like that, is to really value the person and utilize their knowledge and their skills, and that'll help with the connectedness, and that'll help you to be able to detect if something's starting to go off the rails or whatever. And also for family members to learn how to help them change their thinking, how to help them shift their attitude or reframe it. You know, you can do that. You can do it gradually. You don't have to hit them over the head with it. But I think that's something else too, because when we start to get depressed, I tend to frame everything in a negative way. But if I have someone who can start to slowly point me towards the positive way, I'll go there. So that's the only other thing I can think of right now.
That's all. Both very
making sure, good. Making sure that there is an opportunity to gain meaning in life for older people. I think it's all of our jobs to advocate for thinking a little differently about aging and its value. That seems to be a theme that we've come back to a number of times here. But you know, that was that experience and life lost thing. It's what Heidi was talking about there, the library notion. I love that image. But
oh,
this is something to yell about.
Yes, exactly. And I remember one of the wonderful things my father did with his parents as they were getting into their mid-80s is he did an audio tape interview with them about their childhood, about when they met, about, you know, raising him. And to hear their stories in their own voices and also their little, you know, bickering back and forth, absolutely precious, absolutely precious. And I think there's all kinds of new storytelling things you can do with the elders that is just so rich, not just for us, for them, and also for future generations to come. So let me go back and do a little bit of a recap, and then I'll come back to you for any kind of final thoughts, any kind of wrap-up that you want to do. So we started off the conversation really framing this whole conversation about resilience, about looking at our elders, about the fact that, you know, surveys are telling us that they are of high satisfaction in life and that they're happy, happier than most other populations. And so there's a lot of strengths there that we are under-recognizing, and we have a lot to learn from our older adults. And that really one of the things we should be challenging isn't as much the older adults as it is our social constructs around it, about why we are not really focused on all of these benefits that the older adults are bringing. We talked a little bit about shifting the mindset, shifting the language from caretaker to well-being or wellness partner, in that we are benefiting as much, if not more, in this relationship of working with older adults as much as they are. And how we do that is by entering, in large part, into conversations of empathy and compassion. Yates shared with us some very, very important research conclusions about the 5 D's of the risk factors that we also need to be paying attention with, especially among a subpopulation that has incredibly high risk, older white men. And we're not fully understanding why that's the case, but we do know that it is the case. And so we need to be listening to and paying attention to the risk factors and their additive effects on one another among depression, disease, disability, disconnectedness, and deadly means, especially firearms. We talked about the importance about getting our systems and culture to be more age-friendly, and what does that mean? What does it mean to say, I saw you coming, and I'm prepared for you. I have thought through what you might need, and I've listened to your needs, and I am prepared to welcome you so that you feel comfortable and safe wherever we are, in our faith communities, in our primary care, and in our mental health systems. We talked a little bit about the overlap of dementia and depression in older adults. That's probably a whole other conversation, but I wanted to make sure that we dipped our toe in that as well as the important conversation that is probably a whole day to week or year of discussion around self-determination at end of life, and especially around reducing access to lethal means and how that can be done with respect and dignity and collaboration. And then finally, some of the takeaways are that, you know, suicidality, or what we're calling suicide intensity, fluctuates. It goes into more intense forms and less intense forms. And for some people, like Heidi and others, it can be on the menu all the time. When it gets to the more intense forms with older adults, we do need to be more aggressive around keeping them safer for now, which means having important conversations around suicide and access to lethal means and finding a collaborative way to keep people safe for now until we get to the other side of that strong intensity. Great advice from Yates. Let's all keep engaged with life and other people and challenge ourselves to do new things in new communities, in new places, to keep that connection going. And then let's honor the fact that our elders have with them incredible life experiences, wisdom, and knowledge. And with that library of experience, there's so much there to help future generations. So how can we tap into that? And make that available for other family members and other people in our communities for as long as possible. And then let's shift the attitude from a deficit model, a weakness model, a broken model, to one that's positive. And let's advocate for values of our elders and meaning in life throughout the lifespan. So last thoughts, let's start with you, Heidi. Do you have something that kind of sums up your experience and your conversation today?
I think the only thing I can think of is that I urge people to start thinking about getting old when you're in your 40s and start to have a routine, an exercise routine, or start to build your resilience, start to make those connections, start to do everything you can so that when you are 60, 70, it's already ingrained in you, and you'll have those that built in, and you won't have to struggle as much to start it, when you're older.
That's a great point. We don't build resilience in the middle of a crisis. You build it,
right?
It's the mental muscle. You work at it over time so that it's there for you when you hit the crisis. Excellent point. Yates, final thoughts?
Well, your summary was outstanding. I really appreciated the opportunity to participate. I think that we live, unfortunately, still in a rather ageist society, and we all need to be, I think, really thoughtful, mindful about our own attitudes towards aging, and be vigilant in recognizing that suicide, the loss of an older life to suicide, is just as much a loss as suicide at any other point in the life course, and to be creative in thinking about how to assure that we're not robbing older people of the opportunity to have meaning and make contributions, but rather looking to our generation in ways that we can contribute through that, I think, having a potentially powerful impact on reducing overall suicide, morbidity, and mortality in older adults.
I like your attitude. Thank you very much. All right, Yates, if people want to find you, how do they get connected to you? How can they find you?
They can Google me at Yates Conwell, the University of Rochester. There's a web page there, and they can connect that way.
Great. And Heidi, what's the best way for people to reach you?
Probably email, so heidi@heidibryan.com. Easy.
And you also have a website that shares a little bit more about your webinars and other things you're doing. Is that just heidibryant.com?
Right.
Great. Well, thank you very much, both of you. What an insightful and inspiring conversation. There's so much here. I know that many of us have older adults in our family, and we're also aging, so there's just so much takeaway here for all of us. For those of you who enjoyed this episode, please come back. We have all kinds of episodes throughout the year, and you can sign up to the newsletter to find out what's happening at sallyspencerthomas.com. Please leave a rating and review and to subscribe to this podcast on iTunes. That really helps our other people find us when they're looking for this important kinds of conversation. So let me just close with our motto: open your heart, challenge your thinking, and take action to save lives. Together, we can restore dignity and sustain a passion for living.
This is New York firefighter Rafael Poria. Introducing Firehouse Subs' new $4.99 choice subs. Choose from a medium smoked turkey, honey ham, or roast beef. And remember, a part of every sub you buy helps provide life-saving equipment for first responders. Medium $4.99 choice subs. Firehouse Subs. Enjoy more subs. Save more lives. Limited time only, plus tax, no substitutions. Participating locations. Firehouse Subs will donate a minimum of $1 million in 2018 to Firehouse Subs Public Safety Foundation by donating 0.13% of every purchase. This is New York firefighter Rafael Poria. Introducing Firehouse Subs' new $4.99 choice subs. Choose from a medium smoked turkey, honey ham, or roast beef. And remember, a part of every sub you buy helps provide life-saving equipment for first responders. Medium $4.99 choice subs. Firehouse Subs. Enjoy more subs. Save more lives. Limited time only, plus tax, no substitutions. Participating locations. Firehouse Subs will donate a minimum of $1 million in 2018 to Firehouse Subs Public Safety Foundation by donating 0.13% of every purchase.